Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Earlier this year, Republican State Representative Skylar Borglum announced her intention to run for South Dakota's seat in the U.S. Senate currently held by Mike Rounds. Since then, Borglum has introduced a rural education initiative. She has a plan to tackle the national debt, and she also has signed a term limits pledge. An engineer, Borglum is also the co-author of The Fossil Fuel Revolution, Shale Gas, and Tight Oil. Borglum earned a master's degree in petroleum engineering from Montana Technical University. She then enrolled at the South Dakota School of Mines and Technology to earn a doctoral degree in geology and geological engineering while working as a production engineer in an oil field in North Dakota. U.S. Senate candidate Skylar Borglum joins us this morning from the Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio in Rapid City's SDPB studio. Skylar, welcome to In the Moment. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much. It's my pleasure.
So it's always fun to watch when candidates announce that they're running and then wait a little bit and see what are some of the first initiatives that they put forth with. How do you make that a decision? I mean, that's fun for us to watch and talk about. But how do you make that decision as far as, you know, I need to tell people who I am, help them get to know me, and then this is the thing that I want to hit them with first as far as what I think are priorities for this campaign?
Well, this is where I do wish I possessed cloning technology so that I could do all of that all at once.
Right.
But I do not. So the Rural Education Initiative actually started earlier this year before I had any intention of running for the Senate. So that was part of my state representative plan and, frankly, long-term program that I expected to take 3 or 4 years, 2 full terms, to really dig in and understand the history, what was needed, and how we could come up with a second round, as it is, of assisting and helping our public schools across the state. It was during that time when I was out in our rural communities, and I will say I've covered western South Dakota for visiting with superintendents, because most of these conversations happen toward the end of the school year. So I visited with superintendents across West River, Central South Dakota, Southern South Dakota, and even into the southeast corner. So I made a fairly comprehensive stab at it before the decision came that running for Senate was really something that needed to be done. And my rural education initiative will now have to be a bit abbreviated, since I won't have 3 or 4 years to pursue it as thoroughly as I would have liked. But I can say that employing my 20-foot rule, meeting with people where they are at rather than expecting them to come to me, and asking them what they see and what they need, generated the kind of feedback that I wanted. I went in with certain ideas and possible solutions, and what I came away with, what I thought was an issue, wasn't at all, and there were other issues that really do need to be addressed.
Give me an example of one of those issues that you heard and sort of how you heard it for the first time and sort of had to open your mind to contemplate what was really somewhat of a surprise.
So I went in thinking we have the opportunity with the challenge that we have in placing teachers in rural areas with online education and creating online communities in a variety of topics and disciplines, and really giving our rural students just a banner banquet, if you will, of opportunity. Well, they already actually have that. A lot of schools provide that, and our state is really doing an excellent job with that. The two problems, you asked for one, so I'll give you two. The first one that came up is that the paraprofessionals are not included in the teacher population. And this means that their salaries are not covered by that half-cent sales tax that came in. So while these paraprofessionals are frequently in the same bargaining group, meaning they too will and should get raises just like teachers, it's up to the district to find the money to pay for it. It's not covered by the half-cent sales tax because it's only for teachers. So that's the first problem. The second problem that came in was essentially the schools could not sit on or save money if they wanted to look at building a long-term building project. It's a use it or lose it mentality, and that leads to inefficiency and sadly, borrowing money if and when a school does want to build a new facility or a new building or do upgrades. And if there's one thing I learned about rural South Dakotans, it's that they do not like debt. They do not want it. And so to be forced through unintended consequences to have to take on debt and pay for various aspects of their schools is very frustrating and frankly demoralizing.
So tell me a little bit about how that intersects then with your run for U.S. Senate, because you're looking at issues that can be dealt with on a state level, and then you're trying to figure out how to launch a Senate campaign
exactly.
at the same time.
Yeah. Let me take one step back on that previous conversation before we move on, and that is the last thing in the world I want to do is come up with some sort of smash and grab policy. And what the legislators before me put into place was an honest and very very well thought out piece of legislation. But whenever you do something new, you take the risk of unintended consequences and not everything working the way you expected. So I don't want anyone to come away from this conversation thinking that it's a criticism. What I do want is for us to be able to say, look, we took a really good run at it. We thought we got everything hammered out. We missed a few things. We didn't expect a few things. So now let's take a second run at it and tighten it up and make it that much better. I don't believe people, whether they're legislators or educators or, frankly, anyone in the community, to be penalized for trying to bring a new idea forward. It may work. It may not. We have to put it into practice and then reevaluate and move forward. So with that, then that leads me to my federal plan. And when I decided to run for Senate, and I had been asked by a number of people across the state, because they saw me out working, they saw me listening, they saw me interested and wanting to know what was important to them. And the number one topic that kept coming up was creating a smaller government at the federal level. We can do that a number of ways. The first and best way is to just stop spending so much. We don't have a revenue problem. We have a spending problem. And as you know, and many others know, our economy has been quite good for the last several years. And even with our economy doing so well, we still could not stay within our budget. We still couldn't live on what we were bringing in. So the scary part for me with that is, so what happens when times get bad? Because they will, right? Trees don't grow to the sky and markets rarely go to zero. So we know that our economy is cyclical. So when it does turn down, how are we going to handle that? Well, the only way the federal government typically handles it is through more spending. And we're already outspending ourselves and the economy is great.
So when you say you're traveling around and people, the number one thing they're telling you is that they want smaller government at the mm-hmm. federal level. Mm-hmm. They're saying that in different ways, right? And you're kind of categorizing that. But what are they saying? Is it the debt's too high?
The debt is
too many regulations? Like, tell me how they specifically articulate that, because I don't think they probably say, hey, we want smaller government at the federal level. Maybe they do.
Some do. Some do. Some don't know how exactly they want to articulate it. They mm-hmm. just know that we're not staying within budget. And as I mentioned, South Dakotans are very, very good about keeping their books balanced, whether it's at home or in the state. Sometimes people want fewer agencies or they want smaller agencies. They certainly do not want every single agency dipping their fingers into every possible area of life, and I understand that. As a state legislator, I frequently voted against bills that I believed were imposing or maybe flexing the strong arm of the state government and getting into political subdivisions where we did not belong. And so when people are asking me for smaller federal government, part of that is certainly getting back to only spending what we bring in. And part of that is reducing the debt. That's a security issue. And then part of it is just we don't necessarily need every agency getting in every state's business all the time.
All right. So tell me a little bit about the wooden nickel plan.
So this is sometimes you need a bold idea, right, mm-hmm. to get people's attention. And we don't actually do national referendums yet in the United States. And this is what I'm proposing. I don't know if you recall, but United States senators used to be selected by state legislators. And then one of the amendments, I believe it was the 10th Amendment, turned that over to the people in general. So we have a precedent for this. And what I want is if we have spending in the discretionary portion, which is roughly a third of the overall budget, if it goes even beyond 5% increase of the previous year's budget, which is still pretty healthy, then it goes to a national referendum to the people. Do you approve? Yes or no? It's that simple. And it isn't that I want the people to make that decision. What I want is for Congress to wake up and stop spending so much money. So that's essentially it. Wooden nickel plan.
All right. So do you think that people are going to, they're going to, is the impact of that sort of the, you know, the anvil that's hanging over your head then when you're in Congress?
Yes. Yes. And it shouldn't have to be that way. But I'm just frankly gobsmacked at the level of spending, the accumulation of debt. We're covering our deficit by taking on more debt, right? There's no other way to do that. If you lived in a house, for example, and your monthly expenses were $3,000 and were $4,000 and you only brought in $3,000 a month, then that $1,000 difference would have to be covered by credit cards or a loan. That's how they cover it. And that's what they're doing at the federal level, but on eye-wateringly larger scales.
So the Republican Tax Cut and Jobs Act Republicans are saying that, you know, crediting the economic growth with that tax reduction plan, but it also increased the debt significantly.
Yes, it did.
Tell me about that plan and how you would have voted.
That plan, everything that I read about it, and it's, you know, anybody can be a Monday morning quarterback,
sure,
right? So, but I will say that from the statistics and economists that I read, while the tax cuts are always exciting and welcome, there wasn't enough planning on the backside to cover the difference. And so I don't know that I would have voted for that tax cut.
All right, let's talk a little bit about this idea of term limits and making a pledge to not stay forever if you're elected. Why is that important to you?
That's important because it means that people can either get in and get their work done, take their best effort at it, or they stay in and tread water. And I think that if you can't get it done in 12 years, then you should really hand the baton off to the next generation. Two terms is plenty for a senator, three terms for a congressman or congresswoman. And I think that taking that pledge tells my constituents that, look, I'm not looking for a lifelong entitlement at the feeding trough. I want to get in, do the very best job that I can, and then go forward and do something else. There's nothing like a deadline to help you get your work done.
So one of the things that people celebrate about those longer terms of service, though, when you look at a Senator John Thune or even a Tom Daschle before, that the South Dakota can rise in influence over the years if someone stays longer. What would your response to that be?
Well, and certainly Senator Thune has done it within his second term. And I think that's wonderful. We have every reason to be very proud of it. And if I remember correctly, Senator Daschle was a two-term governor or two-term senator as well. Write that in pencil. Don't write that in Sharpie. And so if we aim for that for everybody across the board, and again, that would take an amendment. It's been declared unconstitutional from the state level trying to bring that law forward. But if we get that commitment across the board, then people will show up hungry, they'll show up ready to work, and then when the time is done, they'll go back to their everyday jobs, which is what we're supposed to have, everyday citizens.
All right, and let's talk a little bit about the influence of something like that, you know, voluntary term limits, for example, on growing the next political leaders from the state of South Dakota, because this is something that you have spoken out about. You know, are you encouraged to do that, or are you sort of shoved aside and told not to do that because it's somebody else's time in the spotlight?
Well, of course, there is that, right? And that's to be expected, and I knew that. And I think that it is time for the next generation of leaders to stand up and take responsibility and take their best shot at problem solving. I'm 42 years old. I've had two wonderful careers. One was in business and sales, and then the other was in engineering. And now I'm embarking on a third career, as it were, for a time. It's something that, look, we need fresh ideas. We need enthusiasm. We need people who see the problem from a different perspective and are ready and hungry to get after it and to solve it. And so, yes, of course, I was told to go sit in the corner and color in the coloring book in my within the lines. But that doesn't do anything for the state of South Dakota. We have a number of terrific people who want to lead and who want to participate. And so whether it's an institution like politics or a church or academics, it's okay for the next generation to step up and bring their ideas. Otherwise, we stagnate. And worse, we have people elected for life, and that's not a motivator to get any real work done.
Tell me, as an engineer, what do you think you bring to the national conversation, in the conversation of climate change and other conversations? Where do you see that engineering background being of influence?
That's a great question. So being an engineer has many privileges. One is I can read and interpret data and make long-term decisions. And this isn't something that very many people can do. Our problem-solving skills are rigorously developed, and you have to be able to account for, to the best of your ability, the knowns and the unknowns. And when you look at a problem that needs to be solved, that's when you really dig in and start accounting for the different variables and uncertainties. So you don't find a lot of emotional engineers. we're trained to be reasonable and thoughtful and really just take the data for what they are. So that's what I would bring to the national scene, is somebody who's measured, somebody who does her research, does her homework, and frankly wants to use the data to the best of its ability.
So when you see Democrats in Congress talking about a Green New Deal, talking about oil production, talking about renewable energy, insert yourself into that conversation. What are some of the things that you want people to understand?
Well, in my book that my co-author Dan Soder and I authored or published, it's something that we struggled with, because again, I don't want to come down on somebody's idea that frankly got AOC elected into office. She did a great job recycling an idea that's about 10 years old, and she used it to get elected, so more power to her. The problem is, and I do find that admirable, she sold it, she got in. The problem is, the way our system is set up, it isn't going to work. And numbers vary, but we're talking the cost to families to implement that scheme would be on the order of maybe $65,000, $67,000 per family. Well, the average income, I believe, in South Dakota is somewhere in the low 50s. So there's no way we can afford that. That would crash our economy. The other problem is it really denies the idea or the need for a base load. So however you want to support the base load for generating electricity, whether it's with natural gas or modern nuclear fuel, however you want to do it, you have to have something that's there and consistent. You can use solar power and wind power for peaking. And in some areas, we would have access to geothermal, not everywhere across the United States. So you can't swoop in and say we're only going to use two types of electricity generating mechanisms for our grid when we need to be able to use the entire mix. The other piece I would say is instead of getting ourselves all wound up about it, let's open this up to innovation. And right down the road in Piedmont, we have Genpro. They're developing solar panels, and the solar-powered industry did not receive the same level of subsidies that the wind farms did. So despite the fact that wind farms and wind turbine makers were given a tremendous step up through federal subsidies, solar power has really still held their own and is doing an excellent job. So I think that we have a lot of business opportunity. We have a lot of innovation and technological opportunity that we haven't even begun to tap into.
Do you think the divisiveness of the conversation in the first place is doing long-term damage to finding solutions to climate change that are enough? Because I'm also wondering what you think about whether those efforts would be enough.
I do think that divisive conversations are destructive in just about any context. Now, we don't all have to agree on every single point, right? And I think that if people go into politics believing they're going to come away with 100% of what they want, they're deluded. So we have to share and we have to play nicely together. And so our responsibility as educated, thoughtful, intelligent people is to go in saying, all right, here's where I can negotiate. Here's where I'm willing to compromise. This is the line that I cannot in good conscience cross. But there's a lot of gray area in there where we can work and move forward.
Since we were writing things in pencil, here's the Sharpie version. Tom Daschle was the 3-term senator, and soon, John Thune is now in his 3rd term. And since we mentioned Daschle, I should say that he was on the show once talking about his book that he had written with Trent Lott, and said that there was a real political damage to their willingness to cross the aisle. And you talk about playing nice with the other side. Do voters want someone in Congress playing nice with the other side in 2020?
The voters that I've been visiting with do. Now, they want, obviously, common sense conservative values, and that is what I bring to the table. And yet, I'm still willing on non-politically charged issues to say, let's work across the aisle. And one example of that would be with Representative Mike Saba out of Sioux Falls, where he said and invited me to work with him on international delegations that are coming into the state so that we can help increase, frankly, market opportunities for our ag community here. And so that's not a politically charged situation. That's a how do we help people in the state of South Dakota make more money and bring in more dollars in the state. So in that regard, yes, I do believe there's a lot of opportunity to work across the aisle in bipartisan efforts.
Looking at your videos on Facebook, you've taken the role of often, inviting input and opinions in those Facebook conversations, and also walking people through everything from the myths about immigration to your thoughts on grace, gratefulness, and tact. Tell me a little bit about how you're using social media to work in a campaign where your opponent has a pretty big budget to use against you.
He does. And I'm using social media because it's there and it's very effective. It allows me to interact with people who, frankly, want to be involved. These are not passive voters. These are not passive individuals. These are people who are looking for information. They are looking to find out more about the candidate. They are looking to find out what's going on in the world and how do I understand it and how do I explain it to the next group. And so my reason for using social media is precisely because of its effectiveness. Now, I will say that as somebody who is aligned with the Republican Party and is a conservative, sometimes that doesn't work in my favor. I know that the director of communications and campaign manager that I've retained, she's had some challenges making sure that we're able to get my message out there as a conservative. And that's interesting because I don't believe I put anything particularly incendiary or offensive out there, but sometimes just being a conservative is enough to have people, social media, suspicious, I guess.
So what do you mean? It's being blocked? It's not appearing?
I mean, it's
what are you saying
trying
is happening?
Trying to access various groups. When you're using social media, you can tailor it to people who would be interested in your message, for example, and as a conservative, being able to make use of that tool, right? Because not everybody's going to want to hear my message, and so why clog up the airways? Being able to access people who are fellow conservatives, that's been a challenge on occasion.
Where do you think it's coming from? Where are the barriers?
Well, I don't know. I don't know. And that's a really good question, because as I understand it, this is supposed to be a free and open communication mechanism. And if it is a result of my being a conservative, then I do find that disconcerting.
Interesting. Tell me a little bit about your upcoming Go Ruck Challenge.
So my husband and I are very excited to do this for the first responders and families of 9/11, the victims and families of 9/11, and our service women and men who have been serving continuously now for the last 18 years in the fight against terrorism. And we decided this is a virtual tour that you can do. And so we thought, this is what we want to do to show our solidarity and our support. And so we will be out in the Badlands. Anyone is welcome to join us on the afternoon of September 11th. And we're loading up our bags. You can carry 10 pounds. You can carry 20 pounds. And you march for a 5K and basically demonstrate through your actions that you're in solidarity with the people who are all affected by 9/11.
All right. What are you going to put in your bag?
I have.
It's important, because those rucks are packed with different things.
Yes.
Some people just put a brick in and wrap it up with tape. Other people carry specific things. So what are you going to put in your bag?
I think mine has the head of an old sledgehammer and and a couple of weight plates and some BBs. So it'll hit for sure the 20-pound mark. But it won't be anything sentimental or meaningful.
As you move forward through, and I know you ran a 5K as well and talked about that on Facebook, what are you hearing from voters that they want, other than, you know, what they want out of the federal government, but about your campaign in particular? What resonates with them about you personally as a candidate?
People are so excited that there is someone new and different to vote for. And they're very excited about somebody who really does have common sense, who has the best interests of South Dakota at heart, and frankly, who wants to get in there and just work. That's exactly what I want to do. And I think they find that attitude refreshing.
Do you think it's because of specifically Senator Mike Rounds and what you perceive as his vulnerabilities? Or do you think it goes back to this notion of, we want a fresh face and a fresh voice, and we like changing who represents us in Washington? What's your gut instinct about that? Maybe that's not a good engineering question to ask. What's your gut instinct about that?
My gut instinct says it's a combination of both.
Okay.
It really is. There's a whole host of reasons why people get excited about a new candidate. Sometimes they just want change. Sometimes they just weren't as excited about the previous candidate and want to see if somebody new can do something different. And sometimes they really are ready for a different approach.
All right. Skylar Borglin, we hope to talk to you again in the future. Thanks for being with us here today.
Thank you so much.